I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we're going to be listening to a speech by Ken MacLeod. He's a science fiction writer from Scotland who's written 10 novels. He's known as a very politically engaged science fiction writer who infuses his novels with a sense of political history and the engagement with the political ideas. This talk goes into some of the influences on his writing from his childhood in Scotland to various religious ideas that he's grappled with over the years, as well as the political ideas. So Ken MacLeod speaking on February the 19th, 2006 at the Boscone in Boston.
It says on the program here that I'm a, among other things, Trotskyist libertarian cyberpunk. I'm getting as bored with talking about all three of these subjects as you are no doubt with hearing about them from me. So what I'm going to talk about today is other stuff that has gone into my writing. I'm going to talk about places and landscapes, religions and philosophies, and a little bit about real science and technology and my own experience of them. And it's all going to be mixed up together because that's how they are. If you've read my books, you can make the cross-references yourself, and if you haven't, you needn't worry. I hope the talk will make sense without them. So to begin at the beginning, when I was a little kid, I lived on the island of Lewis, off the northwest coast of Scotland. It's about 50 miles long and 30 miles across, a lump of eroded metamorphic rock with a thin covering of soil here and there, and long sandy beaches on its Atlantic coast. A sad, sad, cynical place that has been the graveyard of many schemes of improvement. It's like in Louis MacNeice's poem Bagpipe Music. It's no go the herring board, it's no go the Bible. All we want is a packet of fags when our hands are idle. Fags in British English means cigarettes, I should explain. And seriously, you can understand about its being sad. Just a couple of generations back, hundreds of young men returning from the First World War on a ship called the Yillera, or as the English called it, the Isle Eyre, drowned within sight of the harbour at Stornoway. That is the sort of luck that Lewis has had. And as you might expect, it is or was, when I was growing up there, totally dominated by Presbyterianism and drink. And because the Presbyterian ministers make sure that most of it is dry, young lads drive for miles and miles on bad roads, drunk, at night, and get killed or crippled in car crashes. The boys who survive go to sea, and the girls go to Glasgow and become nurses. And the only population growth comes from aging hippie new age settlers and entrepreneurs who become suspects in satanic abuse witch hunts. That is a slight exaggeration. For our summer holidays, we used to go to Lough Carron on the west coast of Scotland, which was a very different place. There are trees, and people burn coal instead of peat, and the grocery is a shop and not a van that comes round once a week. And the hills are Torridonian sandstone rather than Lewisian gneiss. Also, it rains even more than on Lewis. It's a few miles north of an area that has the highest rainfall in Western Europe. And not surprisingly, that area is almost uninhabited, at least as far as we know. There could be entire civilizations over there growing rice on terraced hillsides between Strathcarron and Kintail. Now, you might expect that coming from a place like that, I had a really grim childhood. Not a bit of it. I had a very happy childhood, and I still have the scars to prove it. They're on my shins, where I banged them on rocks running about on the hills, mostly downhill. One of the other things that I used to do, both in Lewis and in Lough Carron, was go off on wee expeditions that would have had my mother absolutely frantic with worry if she'd ever known about them, which I made very sure she didn't. Our house was just outside the end of Glen Valtos, which is basically a ravine. There's black cliffs facing each other across a wee river, a burn, and a road. And the wee river was tidal in its lower reaches and had a rock dam, a fish trap, which we were told had been built by the Vikings, which may well be true. I remember my dad, who was a minister, chatting with some quarry workers. one of whom speculated that Glen Valtas was formed at the Passion when the rocks were torn apart. My father's opinion was that it was formed at the Creation. That shows you the kind of place that glen was, and that's how I remember it. From when I was about 8 or 9 years old, I used to go off and wander up the glen and scramble up the sides of it to a sort of nook where I would sit behind a rock and aim an imaginary machine gun at the cars on the roads for miles around. And on one particularly hot, silent afternoon, silent except for the distant din of the crusher at the quarry, I remember stopping in my scramble up the cliff with an odd feeling of presence, like when you're in a room that had seemed empty and you feel that someone else has come in or has been there all the time. I later recognized that same feeling on a likewise hot, silent afternoon in a gully of a river in Lough Carron. I don't have any mystical interpretations of it. In fact, I can think of several testable scientific hypotheses for it off the top of my head, but I can understand why our ancestors found the significance in lonely, rocky places. In Lewis, our ancestors' ruins were all around us, from the half-buried walls of the abandoned crofts to the cattle-droving roads in the hills, likewise abandoned, and the brochs, that's forts, and standing stones that are prominent in various parts of the landscape. G.K. Chesterton remarks somewhere that how in Europe Roman ruins are all around us like the bones of a buried giant. Well, these are older than Rome. And every time I come across some Stone Age place like that, I get this sense of a connection with my ancestors, which is a very tenuous form of the feeling I had a few years ago when I visited my father's grave in the cemetery at Lough Carron, between the loch and the hills. And being a materialist, you know, I had this strange reflection that bones built by the same genes that were right that second building my bones were under that grass. Now that maybe illustrates the sort of connection that place and landscape have in my mind with religion and philosophy. Once again, you might expect that, with my father being a Presbyterian minister and all, I grew up with strong religious feelings and convictions. And once again, I have to say, not a bit of it. I heard every word of the Bible, and I believed every word of it, but it had no spiritual effect whatsoever. I learned all the theology from the Westminster Confession and the Shorter Catechism, and I believed it to be true, but I couldn't see any reason why anyone would want it to be true. In my late teens, I remember reading lots of bad apologetics put out by the InterVarsity Press and other such evangelical publishers. And they would argue that the only alternative to Christianity was some sort of brutal free-for-all, the three bad ends, Nietzsche, nihilism, and Nazism. And it suddenly struck me that the Greeks and the Romans and the Chinese had managed perfectly well in respect of values and morals and so on without having heard of Christianity at all. And the fever left me. Now, I should say in courtesy to those of you who are Christians that I now well recognize the intellectual and emotional appeal of the Christian religion, but I have to say that the version of it that I was taught may be a little different from the one that you believe in. I should also say that this rather unpromising and uncompromising religion produces some truly admirable people, and I'm not one of them. The first book I ever read that really made me see the point and appeal of any religion was Thomas Paine's The Age of Reason. By the time I read it, I was already an atheist, and the demolition of biblical literalism and the contradictions in the narratives and the moral atrocities of Joshua and all of that were all stuff I'd worked through already, mainly from a wonderful little book called The Bible Handbook, which is a cut-and-paste job on King James. You know, it's almost too easy. It's like shooting coelacanths in a barrel. So what struck me most forcibly about Paine wasn't his biblical criticism, but his deism. He said, "I believe in one God and no more, and I hope for happiness beyond this life. My country is the world. To do good is my religion. My own mind is my own church. The word of God is the creation we behold." You read this, well, I read this, and you think, wow, that's some powerful religion. And you look around for deists, and you find there aren't any, or hardly any, and you sort of wonder where it all went, in terms of any effect on the world. And then you look around again, and you realize it's all around you. It's America. That's what the deists gave us. It's their creation we behold in America. And yes, in the deistic sense, I'm very happy to say God bless America. There is, however, a little problem there which I'll come back to. But ever since then, I've had some affection for the rationalistic religions, the deists and pantheists and Unitarians. And you can see that in some of my books. The feeling I got as a child on the side of the glen made these kind of religions emotionally as well as intellectually understandable. The book where that comes out most strongly is The Sky Road, where in a far future society, the people believe in what they call the natural and rational religion. Now, that's actually quite plausible. There are peasants in Transylvania, I didn't know this at the time when I wrote it, but there are peasants in Transylvania who have been Unitarians since the Reformation, with their own clergy, their own churches, their own theological colleges, and they've survived centuries of persecution from Catholics, Protestants, Nationalists, Communists, and so on. And they're still there, still flourishing, and still believing firmly that God is one. The narrator at one point is walking alone in the great Glen of Loch Carron, and he's looking at these ancient Torridonian hills, and he feels isolated from everything except God's terrible love. That experience of presence and emptiness is also quite significant, not for the plot, but for the character who has it, in my first novel, The Star Fraction, where Mo Cohn finds it in a virtual reality. He has this vision in a virtual reality of what is told in the text as a void with the echo of a laugh, like the 2.76K background. John Wilde in The Stone Canal refers to an odd experience he had when long ago he stuffed his face with magic mushrooms. He has a vision where he sees three goddesses, Mother Nature, Lady Luck, and Miss Liberty, and he interprets them as necessity, chance, and freedom. I'm not going to say who I saw when I did the same thing. I had a very odd moment when I saw the window of the room I was in as if it was stained glass, blue and white. And then, believe it or not, I saw a radio telescope transmitting the codes for the molecules in the mushrooms. So I guess I had a materialist vision after all. I became a big enthusiast for the ancient materialists, the Stoics and the Epicureans. In my early 20s, I read Lucretius, The Nature of the Universe, and was completely blown away. Later, I read bits and pieces of Epicurus and Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, and they confirmed my earlier notion that the Romans really didn't need revealed religion to tell them what was right and wrong. By the way, there's a lively new translation by Gregory Hayes of Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. The British poet Blake Morrison reviewed it in The Guardian. He said, "The translation doesn't shrink from anachronism. There's talk of atoms." Just as well he wasn't reviewing Lucretius. So when I got round to writing Cosmonaut Keep, my fourth novel, I had great fun inventing the rites and mores of a religion based on the teachings of the ancient materialists. It was partly inspired by an essay by J.B.S. Haldane, the great British biologist and science writer, on religious liberty, in which he describes the state of religious liberty in the Republic of Krasnia, where the official religion is dialectical materialism. But there are traces of the old religion, mechanistic materialism. For example, the chief materialist pours oil on the chief commissar when he's appointed. And this is a relic of the old belief that man is a machine and needs oiling. One of the things that the ancient materialists had was a sort of relaxed view of sex as such, but they rather frowned upon falling in love. So in that book, I had a society where erotica was sold openly above the counter and furtively under the counter in plain covers. You had romance novels, love stories. Contrary to what some people think, I don't usually advocate the policies adopted in the societies I imagine, but in that instance, I might make an exception. Another philosopher who is arguably in the tradition of materialism and rationalism is Spinoza. Spinoza was probably the first person to publicly point out in print the sort of things about the Bible that Thomas Paine did later. He rather cleverly said that they must have been foisted on the sacred text by impious hands. This didn't fool the Dutch Calvinist ministers or the rabbis of Spinoza's own Amsterdam Jewish community for 1 minute. Spinoza's philosophy was a sort of rationalistic monism that identified God with nature, although not, of course, the nature that we see, a notion he indignantly repudiated. But for some reason, rabbis and ministers yet again, well, you know how it goes. I don't claim to understand Spinoza. He's a very clear but very difficult philosopher. But I put a lot of whatever it was I took from him into Newton's wake. And not just the passage where Lucinda answers a question about physics by saying, God or nature, aye. Spinoza made some interesting contributions to political philosophy, one of which was when he argued that Thomas Hobbes was a bit of a woolly-minded idealist. Hobbes is usually credited with tough-minded realism. There's a British political philosopher called Ted Honderich who relates that one of his students wrote in an essay about Hobbes. Hobbes tells us that life in the state of nature is poor, solitary, nasty, British, and short. But what Hobbes came up with to get us out of the state of nature was the social contract. We secure ourselves by turning over our power to the sovereign, who can then do no wrong. It seems very hard-headed, particularly in comparison with Hobbes's main competitor at that time in the field of political philosophy, Sir Robert Filmer, who wrote a book called Patriarchia, which justified government on the basis that all kings were the legitimate descendants on the male side from Adam, who had been given the world by God. Now, Locke had quite a lot of fun dealing with some of the problems of that theory. And Locke, following Hobbes, based his concept of government on the idea of the initial contract, even a hypothetical initial contract. What Spinoza saw was that making this contract, whether it was real or imaginary, the basis of legitimate authority, was both destabilizing and unnecessary, as well as untrue. You all know the words, to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. You can hear them read out from the balcony of the old State House in Boston every 4th of July. They're very inspiring, but unfortunately they're not actually true. Governments do not originate in any kind of contract or consent, but in conquest, as we see every other week on CNN. David Hume got it precisely right when he wrote, "Into how many shapes have political reasonings been turned in order to avoid an obvious, but it seems too homely a truth? The patriarchal scheme is nonsense. The original contract is opposed by experience. Men are unwilling to confess that all government is derived from violence, usurpation or injustice, sanctified by time, and sometimes by a seeming imperfect consent." Now, scholars have argued about what Hume's politics actually were, but none of them have ever accused him of being an anarchist. He wasn't bothered by the unjust and violent origins of government. The powers of government can be just, according to Hume, and can be exercised justly with or without the consent of the governed. The imagined rational beings who signed the imagined social contract wouldn't have needed a government in the first place, but we do. Spinoza has a very precise and realistic view of human psychology, and it is not that of primarily rational beings who, you know, can calculate what their interests are and will sign a contract and agree to it. Now, one interesting consequence of this is that libertarianism is mistaken insofar as it is based on the idea of a social contract, as in the writings of Robert Nozick, or in the idea that there is no social contract and therefore all authority is illegitimate, which is just taking the same idea from the other end. Or that if there isn't a social contract, then there bloody well ought to be. Why should I do this? I never signed up for it. It all sounds very teenage. Spinoza moved political philosophy away from this sort of petulance and towards something a bit more realistic. But I'm not claiming that he would have thought it probable that the galaxy could be ruled, and not entirely unjustly, by a Glasgow crime family. Now we come to the science bit. One of the things you might expect from what I've said about my upbringing I said that I had a lot of scientific creationist nonsense shoved down my throat in my early years, and that discovering the truth about biology and geology and evolution would have been a shocking revelation, and that I would be very bitter and twisted about how I had been misled. You would be absolutely right. I think I got as far as first year at university, still thinking that even if creationism wasn't true, there might be something in its criticisms of biology, of, you know, all this scientific orthodoxy. Maybe the creationists had managed to pick some holes in it. This misconception lasted all the way into the first chapter of reading the standard textbook, Keaton's Biological Science. As usual in such matters, it was something quite trivial that tipped the balance. In this case, it was Keaton's pointing out an obviously vestigial organ, the dew claws of pigs. Why, Keaton asked, would the Creator have given pigs, which walk on only two toes per foot, two other toes that dangle uselessly well above the ground? I had no answer to that, but I'm sure the Institute for Creation Science has several. Sometime later, I went on to read The Origin of Species, and I found out just how badly it had been misrepresented to me, and also, and more seriously, how strong Darwin's argument was. The reason, by the way, why I was studying biology in the first place is that reading SF had given me the misguided ambition of being a scientist. And despite getting to the level of first-year physics at university, I was very bad at maths. I was good at arithmetic, but I didn't understand mathematical reasoning at all. At some level, I must have thought of maths as if it was something empirical, sort of like the molecular equations in chemistry. I do, in fact, remember when I was a little kid, and I really do remember this, thinking that the rule of carry one, take away one, must have been discovered by some very clever person in ancient times, probably Socrates. It was only when studying over that summer, first year summer at university, to resit my university first year physics exam, which I did eventually pass, that I grasped the fact that what was on one side of an equal sign was a rearrangement and restatement of what was on the other. I had just read A.J. Ayer's Language, Truth and Logic, and I'd been much seized of his point that logic is tautology. And that is the sole reason that I eventually figured out what was going on in equations. I went around for days telling people that the terms on both sides of an equal sign are the same but stated differently. I'd have got fewer funny looks if I had an albatross around my neck. I'm still making discoveries like that. Last year, I started rereading Mathematics for the Million by Lancelot Hogben, which is, I should explain, is a great introduction to mathematics and making sense of mathematics, using both logical proof and historical, the historical development of maths. And I got to the proof that the sum of the angles in a triangle is equal to two right angles. And I followed it through, and I understood it. Yes! This is one of those eternal truths in the mind of God that Spinoza was on about. And I swear that up until then, I must have vaguely imagined that this had been discovered empirically. Oh, Pythagoras, do your measurements of this triangle's angles add up to 180 degrees? Indeed they do, O Socrates. Plus or minus 0.01%. We have now measured 486 triangles with the same result. That is statistically significant, O Pythagoras. Indeed it is, O Socrates. You are right again as usual. So once again I went around for days telling people all about it and drawing lines on the backs of envelopes and in beer slops on pub tables. As a student of biology, I had a fantastic time, particularly with paleontology and marine biology. I did a practical course in marine biology in Millport on the Clyde. My own project was an investigation of something I'd noticed that summer, which was that exposed barnacles on a sun-dried rock will react to the slightest splash of salt water. And I wondered if their reaction time was related to how long they'd been out of the water and whether it's water. Now, all I could do was study their behavior using beakers and pipettes. So, behaviorism being very popular at the time, I called it the psychology of barnacles. We collected specimens on the shore and went out in our research vessel, an old converted fishing boat, and collected more from the sea and sorted them all out. And it's a fact that you can find specimens of almost every phylum between the high tide and the low tide marks. It's really amazing how they all got sorted into separate strata in the flood. And all of that I did at Millport went into the engines of light books, like seafood going into chowder. In a different way, so did the hot-blooded dinosaurs. As a student, I heard one of the first public presentations of the argument that dinosaurs were hot-blooded, and I heard the collective sharp intake of breath and the nervous laughs when Alan Charig, or whoever it was, put up a slide showing the new classification that followed from that. Instead of having birds, mammals, and reptiles, you had mammals, reptiles, and dinosaurs, with birds in class Dinosauria, subclass Aves. In 1975, saying that birds are dinosaurs was really going out on a limb. Since then, we've found a limb, and it has feathers. I went on to research the biomechanics of bones, and eventually got a research degree so much later that my wife, Carol, and two kids are in the graduation photo. By then, I'd found my own ecological niche as a computer programmer, having discovered that programming is not at all like mathematics and was much more like the sort of empirical practice that I had mistakenly imagined mathematics to be. At least, it is the way I practiced it. A few months ago, I was talking to my friend Tony, who works in IT, and who used to work with Charlie Stross. He asked me how my latest novel was coming along, and I said that for me, writing was a lot like programming. You start by spending days on end staring miserably at a blank screen and a few pathetic scrawls on an otherwise blank sheet of paper. Tony said, yeah, it's like that for me too. But I remember when Charlie worked with us, he would just look at the spec, then start coding like a man possessed. Well, for me, writing is different. It sometimes feels like the great work in Cosmonaut Keep, a book that has a lot more of my experiences in IT strung through it. Come to think of it, it has Charlie and Tony in it. Tony is the guy who says, Karl H. Marx on a bicycle, Charlie, aren't aliens enough? I worked in the IT industry for 10 years, and I could still do that if I had to, but I hope I don't. I like being a science fiction writer, and I like the fact that you can shove all your experiences into it. Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high-tech and yet radically democratic future.